want you to join me in a bit of a thought experiment this morning, and I genuinely want you to think it through. Take off your I'm in church kind of knee-jerk reaction to the question, and really be honest with yourself. I won't quiz you on it later. You can hold it just before you and the Lord. What if I was to say to you, if the Lord was to say to you, that He would gladly and willingly be there for you in any time of need. He would keep you safe throughout your present journey in life. He would provide for every particular need you may have financially and emotionally. And that He would ultimately just give you what you needed as far as provision was concerned. And He would keep you safe. But at the same time, the arrangement would be that He would keep at a distance, that there would be no relational contact between you and God. He would be there sort of as, you know, your genie in a bottle whenever was necessary. But there would be no communion between you and your Heavenly Father. Would you take that arrangement? What's interesting is, as we think about that, I mean, isn't that pretty much just the summary of American Christianity in general? That is really the purpose that God serves. And I think many of us in this nation would be perfectly delighted if God promised that, yeah, He's going to meet every one of our needs. He's going to prosper us. We will be abundant and we will be safe. And we don't have to have any interaction with Him. That's the only caveat. I think for most of us, we think, well, where's the drawback? I mean, isn't that, don't we just deal with God only because these other things are a direct result of our relationship with Him, and because we need those things, we go to Him? And I think many people, when put to that particular question and that particular test, would be more than content to say that, yes, I will take that, a good life, prosperity, and no communion with God. I'd be all right with that. Well, the reason that comes up is because what we enter in our text this morning. If you'll remember, this text comes to us in a book that has one large story that's being told. And the story is the redemption of God's people. This is the salvation story of the Old Testament. It will be brought up time and time again through each one of the other books of history in Israel. It will be brought up throughout the prophets. This is their salvation story. It'd be like trying to talk about Christianity without the cross. Talking about Israel's history without the Exodus is impossible. This is how they were constituted a people. This is their salvation. And the reason, you will remember, that God saved them is that through them, He was going to make His name known to all the nations. That through being their God and delivering them and showing His power on their behalf, bringing them into a land, that all the nations surrounding them would see the glory of their God and ultimately be in awe of the God of Israel because of what He does through this particular nation. Their goal is to glorify His name in order to draw the nations in. But you also remember that this particular text comes to us at the tail end of the book, where Israel has not quite lived up to that expectation. Remember, this text is part of the worshiping the golden calf incident. This is the next chapter after that incident. It really is all one long incident, but because we don't have that kind of time, nor would I want to test your patience in that way, we're going to break it up into a few Sundays. But they have just worshipped the golden calf. They have ultimately revoked the covenant that God has made with them. They have shown that they are faithless. And now we have this current scenario that we're reading this morning. And the problem, ultimately, is brought to us in chapter 33. This is the problem of the text in our first point, that God will not dwell with Israel. You'll notice the arrangement that God offers them. He says in verses 1 through 3, go up. I will fight for you. You will be safe. I'll take care of all of the Perizzites and the Hizzites and everyone else in that whole list of names. And they will be dealt with at my hand and you will be protected. I will bring you into a land that I promised. And that land will be abundant. Notice what he says. It will be a land flowing with milk and honey. And so notice what they're offered. They are offered safety and they're offered provision and provision in abundance. And here's the only caveat. The arrangement is good. The only problem is God's absence. I will not go up among you. I will not be in your midst. And notice the reason he gives. He says, if I did, I would consume you because you are a stiff-necked people. And it gets repeated twice in the text. It says, if we were to go up and I was to be in your midst the whole time, out of sheer mercy's sake, I'm not going to go with you because I would have to consume you because of your rebellion. You've already shown it in worshiping the golden calf. I know who you are, and therefore, here's the deal. I will go before you. You will see the way the text says he's going to send an angel before them. And a lot of people believe, well, okay, so God's going to send an angel, and then he's going to be removed. But notice, he says, I will send an angel, and I will ultimately drive out the Perizzites and the Hittites. The angel is the angel we see in Exodus and other places, the angels of God's presence. It's not like God is saying, I won't be there, just the angel will be there. Instead, he's saying, I will be there in the presence of this angel, but I will go before you. I'm not going to go with you. So I will lead the way. I will get you to enter in, but I'm not going to live among you as I had spoken previously. Now, what makes that so damning, really, is where this text comes in Exodus. Now, remember, what provoked the golden calf incident? Moses is gone for 40 days. The people are impatient because they can't, they don't know what's going on with him, and they don't have any tangible way, you know, to worship their God. And so they say, let's build this calf. But what was Moses doing for 40 days? For 40 days, God was literally giving him the specs and the blueprint on the tabernacle where God would live among Israel, where his glory would settle among the nation. And as he's getting all the directives for how God is going to live among the people, this incident is happening below, and now we're being told about it. And you'll see the rest of the book of Exodus is going to take up the tabernacle again. So you've got several chapters giving all the details of the tabernacle. You have the golden calf incident, and then you have all those same details repeated again. Why is it given to us in that strange order? Have you ever read the Old Testament? You think, like, didn't we already read this 6 chapters ago? He's telling us about all the same furniture in the tabernacle that he just told us, you know, 7-8 chapters ago. Well, it's in order to draw attention to the fact that in the center of God saying, I'm going to live among the people, is this particular happening where Israel revokes God through worshiping the golden calf. The purpose of the tabernacle was ultimately that God would dwell in the middle of Israel. But here, now in chapter 33, that whole idea that God would dwell in the middle of Israel is now off the table. He says, I'm just not going to do that anymore. I'll keep my promise. I'll bring you to the land. And it will be abundant, but I'm not going to be in your midst. In fact, the reason we have this weird interlude in the text in verses 9 through 11 is that he's telling us how it's going to function. How's it function now? All the people live in the middle of the camp, and there's a tent outside of the camp. And anytime God wants to meet with Moses at the present time, Moses walks outside of the camp, and all the people watch from a distance at their tent door, and God settles over the tent. Him and Moses speak face to face, and then God leaves, and Moses comes back in. And God's saying, that's just going to be the arrangement from here on in, but I can't live among you, because if I live among you, I'm going to kill you, because you are a stiff-necked people. This is the big issue of this particular text, and maybe it doesn't feel that big to us, because in one sense, it seems like that doesn't sound like a bad deal. You know, God doesn't want to kill them. That's great. And he's still going to provide for them. And they're going to be safe. All the benefits, just none of the presence. None of his personal presence. I'm sure we've had relationships like that before in our family, where maybe we get benefits from certain people in the family. We don't necessarily like them. We don't want to be around them. And if we could somehow secure all of those same benefits and not have them around, we'd be perfectly content with that happening. But, you know, because the in-laws are so nice at giving, well, we'll just put up with it. Or because, you know, Uncle Louie, he always gives us good Christmas presents. We'll pretend to like him while he's here. And I think for a lot of us, unfortunately, the idea of communion with God or being in God's presence isn't really a big part of our Christianity. And yet what is being taught to us in this text is that it is the main part of what's going on here in Israel. And it is also the main part of your whole destiny. I mean, your goal, the end of your life, what you are headed toward, is what theologians have called in the past, you know, the beatific vision, or what we see in Revelation 21 and 22, that there's no tabernacle there, there's no temple there, because the Lord is the temple, and we are always in his presence. This is the goal of our existence. And if that goal isn't exciting to us or isn't even appealing to us, then there's something seriously flawed in our religion and the way that we hold it. It is not the Christian faith that you're holding to. It's some perversion because somehow we have disjointed God from the faith altogether. And we instead have exchanged it with the benefits of God in place of his person. Notice the people get it. They understand how bad it is. Verse 4, the people heard this as a disastrous word and they mourned and no one put on his ornaments. Notice their reaction was life in the good land without God is not good. That it's not enough. It's not what we want. This isn't what we desire. There's something deeper at stake. God is not just our sugar daddy. And that really does need to be brought into focus for us as, you know, modern Christians. The Lord himself is the reward of the Christian faith. That is the greatest gift that we are going to be given. And we need to begin to wrap our minds around that. And Lord willing, this text this morning will draw us into that and see why it is so wonderful that that is the gift that he gives. Beware of false religion that would have God as a number on speed dial or a fix-it man, but not as the goal and the end of your faith. Well, that is the problem, that God's presence will not be with them. But notice Moses then addresses the problem by several pleas in the text. He pleads with God on two different occasions. And you will see as he does this, never once does he plead on the basis of the people. He doesn't say, I mean, consider the people. How could he? He's even acknowledged they have sinned an ugly sin, a great sin before your face. But he does plead the favor that he has with God. You'll notice he keeps saying that. Well, if I found favor in your sight, and since you keep saying I have favor in your sight, then do these things. This seems to be the routine of his intercession. And notice as he does so, maybe you heard it even in the reading out loud in English, because he's pleading God's favor for himself, he keeps incorporating the people. Well, if you're going to have favor on me, then have favor on them. And every time God promises us something, like he says, you know what, I'm going to take you in the land. And he says, I will give you, singular, Moses, I will give you rest. And then God, Moses responds, hey, if you're not going to go with us, then we don't want to go. But rather bring them and me into the land. Bring Israel and myself into the land. He keeps incorporating himself and Israel. If you're going to have favor on me, then include the people because I'm joining myself to them. That there's this solidarity between Moses and the nation. You'll notice in verse 14, the Lord's first response is seemingly uncertain. At least it comes off that way because Moses continues to plead with God in verse 15. And he begins with saying, if you won't go with us. Verse 14 seems to answer the question. He goes, oh, my presence will go before you and I'll give you rest. Well, done deal. But Moses says, if you won't go with us, right after. So clearly there's some uncertainty with Moses concerning the Lord's response. And I do think it has to do with the fact that he says, I will give you rest, Moses. But he's not necessarily guaranteeing it for the nation. He says, if you won't go, Moses responds, then we shouldn't leave. There's no point in bringing us into the promised land if you're not going to be there in the middle of us. He says in verse 16, how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight? Notice, I and your people. So he's first time he plays says, I know I found favor in your sight. And I says, now, if I found favor in your sight, me and your people, he keeps, you know, putting his arm around them and bringing them in. He says, is it not this? Is it not your going with us so that we are distinct? I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth. Moses says, we don't want the land and riches. That's not enough. We don't want just abundance. What separates us from the nations is you. What makes us different and distinct from everyone else is that you've put your name on us. And the whole reason for our existence was that we were to give glory to you and your name in our midst so the nations would see you. And be glad in glorying in you and being drawn to you. And if I have found favor with you and your people, then you've got to hear me. Remember, the goal was to bring God glory, the whole goal of the Exodus, to honor his name so that he might be known among the nations. And if he's going to bless them, if he's going to do anything for them, he's going to do it originally in order to magnify his name. But now Moses is saying, if you're just going to bless us and not magnify yourself, we don't want that. The whole goal of our redemption was that your name would be known. And so do it ultimately for yourself is what Moses is pleading with the Lord. And notice the Lord's response. The very thing that you speak, I will do. God agrees with Moses and he says, I'll do it. I will go with you. Why does he go out of his way to do that? Why does this seal the deal for God? Notice, because he appeals to the Lord's purpose for Israel and his purpose for the existence of the whole of the creation. God's purpose for making all things and for calling to himself a people was to magnify himself. And so Moses says, save us by going with us in order that your name would be magnified. Remember, that's what makes us different. And the Lord says, yes, in order to glorify myself, Moses, I will do what you have said. He redeems them for his name's sake. The Lord will make his name known. He will put them in the land and he will put his name on them in the land. I mean, that is what this whole book's been about. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should serve, that I should obey him? When God thwarts Pharaoh, he says, don't worry. Here's what I'm going to do for you, Israel. In order to make my name known among all the nations, I'm going to overturn him. Moses passing the burning bush. First request he has is, tell me your name. And that will turn into this text. Show me your glory. He has made Israel a people. He has made us a people in order to bring himself glory. And that is why Moses was not satisfied with the original offer. And that is why if we are truly trusting in Christ, we should not be satisfied with the reality of we will take all of God's benefits, but not be able to enjoy his glory or his presence. And this is the reason that you have been set apart as a people, is to magnify the name of the Lord. That is the good life for us. Without the glory of God, there is nothing good, not truly. I mean, we can have all sorts of rewards on this earth. Many people do. And yet to have them apart from God robs of them all of their meaning and their significance and their joy, as we will see. And as soon as God concedes to Moses and says, OK, I will go. There's a strange turn. Moses says, show me your glory. You know, seems to be a very odd way to enter into this particular discussion. Moses will see the Lord's back, but the main focus is on what Moses sees, you'll notice. The text doesn't focus on the vision that Moses had first. It focuses on what the Lord pronounces as he passes by. It is the words he speaks concerning himself and about his character. As he defines his name, he is revealing his glory. It's not, you know, the shine that comes later that is the entirety of God's glory. It is his character that he's about to reveal here is going to reveal to Moses the very glory of God. The name is the revelation. It is the glory. Well, notice we have the problem, which is God's presence. We have Moses' plea, which God answers in the affirmative. And then the text ends with God's presence once again and a further problem. This final petition, show me your glory. We'll notice that once the glory passes, once the goodness of God goes before the face, or at least partially before the face of Moses, once God's nature is known, Moses immediately asks God to forgive the people. He says, notice how he pleads. I have found favor with you. Please go with us because we are a stiff-necked people. Now, the reason God said, I can't go with you is because you're stiff-necked. And as soon as he passes before Moses, go with us because we are stiff-necked, which seems like a strange turnaround. But notice with it, he says, and pardon us and take us for your inheritance. This goodness, whatever it is that Moses has revealed to him, is the glory of God. It is who he is. And it motivates Moses to now say, you can go with us. We will still be stiff-necked. We're not the ones that are changing. Nothing's changing in us. We are a terrible people. And yet we know you. And pardon us, therefore, because of who you are. And after it, notice in verse 10, God reinstates the covenant. He says, all right, Moses, get some stones. And then he reinstates the covenant. He says, I'm going to do something with this people the world's never seen. So somehow the problem is solved in this revelation. Somehow we are moved from I'm going to kill them in chapter 32 to a broken covenant where the tablets are shattered and God says they're not my people, they're your people, Moses, to now where God's saying I'm going to do a wonderful thing with this people before the face of all of the earth. The book of Exodus will end with the glory cloud of God filling the temple, God dwelling in the middle of his people. But the question is, how can God dwell among a people who have so plainly rejected him and failed him, defamed his glory, exchanged his name for the name of lesser gods? I mean, the law was given by this God and broken immediately. His honor was what was at stake, and he was dishonored as soon as they had opportunity. We can say, well, you know, it's clear because in chapter 34, we're told that the Lord is gracious. And that is true. I will be gracious to whomever I will be gracious. I'll have mercy on whomever I want to have mercy. The Lord is gracious and merciful, abounding in love. But notice, as the Lord reveals himself, he doesn't just say that he's gracious. He also says, a God in verse 7 who will by no means clear the guilty, but instead will visit the iniquities of the fathers on the children and the children's children. I think to quickly just say, well, it's because God is gracious, as true as that is, doesn't deal with what else the Lord has just revealed about himself, which is he will never clear a guilty one. So how do we solve this problem? You'll notice that Exodus 33 and 34, while it gives us a hint as to how this problem might be solved, that God is a gracious God and yet he's one who holds people guilty, the Old Testament can never fully reveal how God does these things. I mean, isn't that what we're told in the book of Romans and in Hebrews, that God over long periods of time had forbearance waiting for a further time of revelation? He didn't strike out against people immediately because he was waiting and waiting for this other revelation that he had. Or the book of Hebrews, we learn that the sacrifices never really took away sin. They couldn't really appease God. So somehow God was waiting to reveal himself. He wasn't breaking out against the people. And yet he doesn't fully reveal how he's going to do that in the Old Testament. And the fact is, we've been in the book of Exodus long enough to know you can't understand the book of Exodus just within the book of Exodus. Not truly. You can't understand what the tabernacle means without the New Testament. You can't understand who Moses is without knowing who Jesus is. And so in order to solve this problem, we can't merely stay here, but we have to run really forward in history to see how God is going to show us how he possibly does this, how he renews a covenant with the people and dwells among them and is willing to actually tabernacle with them, even though they are a stiff-necked people. And you'll notice that John, in the very first chapter of his gospel, sees it. And he pushes us back into the scene in Exodus 33. It's hard not to see it. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And we have beheld his glory. What does Moses say? Lord, show me your glory. And John says, we've beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father. What's he like? He's full of grace and truth. The Lord, the Lord. Gracious and merciful. It's interesting, the words that are used there. You know, Hesed and Emet. He's covenantally faithful. He's a God who keeps his word. Well, how does he do that over and over in the Old Testament? By being gracious to a people who don't live up to their end of the bargain. He's full of faithfulness. What does that mean? He's a God who tells the truth. He keeps his promises. What he says holds true. And by the time we get to the New Testament, John says, well, look at Jesus. He's full of grace, covenant faithfulness, and he's full of truth. He's one who keeps his word. And we have beheld his glory. And then it says in verse 14, of course, the word became flesh and did what? He tabernacled in our midst, among us. He dwelled among us. The very thing that's the topic of chapter 33. Can God dwell among his people? Of course not, because he's going to kill them all if he does. Well, John is able to see in the life of Christ that what is being answered here in what is being asked here in Exodus 33 is being answered in the life of this one particular human being. When Moses says, show me your glory, we know that God tells us he's going to let his goodness pass before Moses. And when that goodness passes before him, he tells us all about his character. This is who I am. But when John says we have seen, we have beheld the glory of God in Jesus Christ, he's saying the same thing. God's goodness passed before us. We learned all about how good God was or what his glory was like by learning about his person, about his character. And he's full of grace and truth. Well, what does glory look like in the Gospel of John? Because that's what we see. We have beheld the glory of Jesus. And when John's saying we've beheld his glory, he's writing about the after the fact. He knows about the death, the resurrection, the ascension. What is he writing about? What moment or what particular revelation did they get where he's saying, I've beheld the very glory of God? Notice at what moment the revelation we see God's glory, much like in Exodus 33, when the Lord passes before Moses in the rock. John tells us in John chapter 12, Jesus answered them and says, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it will bear much fruit. Now, listen, my soul is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this reason, I have come to this hour, for this purpose. Father, glorify your name. And a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and I will glorify it again. The crowd that stood there heard it and said that it thundered. Another said, an angel has spoken. And Jesus answered, the voice has come for your sake and not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of the world be cast out. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. We are told, according to John, that the Father's glory is revealed right here. The Son is glorified right here in this particular action, in this particular hour, the hour of Christ's crucifixion. It is in this hour that we see Jesus full of grace and truth. It's here where we behold his glory. The grace and truth carries with it the very judgment of the world, the defeat of the enemies of God's people. I mean, isn't that what God does in the Exodus? He judges the Egyptians. And in so doing, he's honored and glorified. He casts out or he defeats the enemies of God's people so they can be set free. God is honored in this way. And here, through the crucifixion, notice the world is judged. The enemies are defeated. The people of God are forgiven. And through it all, God is honored. Mercy and judgment are executed for the one purpose that was Israel's purpose. The honor of the name of God. So what? I'm the Lord, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. I will by no means clear the guilty. And that is true. But it's not seen how God is going to resolve that reality until years later in this hour. God is glorified. Here the world is judged. But the world is judged in Jesus Christ, who is receiving the judgment. Here our enemies are cast out. In Jesus Christ, who is receiving the death of an enemy. And here and only here can the people of God be cleared and forgiven, because God will by no means clear the guilty. It is only when he deals with guilt once and for all by judging Christ as a victim and counting him worthy of death in our stead that he can be both just and the justifier of those who have sinned against him. But notice, in this hour when I am lifted up, I will draw all peoples to myself. And what was the goal of the Exodus? That Israel would follow God. He would dwell in their midst and all the nations would see and be glad. And here Jesus says, I am on the cross, the only faithful Israelite, God tabernacling in your midst, who is being judged as an enemy. And I'm showing you the very glory of God in my death. I'm showing you both his grace and his truth. And in this action, the whole world will honor God. I will draw all peoples to myself. He takes on the very calling of Israel, even in his crucifixion. And in this way, on the cross, God is made known. And if you want to know God, if you want to know what he's like, look right here to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That is where he revealed his glory most clearly, far more clearly than he ever revealed to Moses who only saw his back, we have beheld God himself in the very face of Jesus Christ. And he is a crucified God, a God willing to give himself up for sinners. This God who desires his own glory above all else. He desires it so much. It's the only thing that turns him in his argument with Moses. God says, do it for your own sake. Remember, you are going to glorify yourself through us. This is what makes us distinct. Therefore, hear me for your own namesake. And God changes his mind. A God whose whole goal is the glory of his name. His desire is that his fame be known throughout all of the earth. He is made known through all the earth by putting aside that glory and being defamed as a sinner. By pouring himself out completely. And not by filling himself up or puffing himself up. His selfishness, if you will, is shown most supremely in his utter self-giving for the sake of sinners. If you want to know who God is, if you want to try to understand the majesty and the glory of God, you have to see him through this event. And it's only then that you know, yes, he's a God who glorifies himself above everything. And yet he does so by making himself of no reputation and coming in the form of a servant in order to redeem his own people from their own rebellion. For indeed, they are a stiff-necked people. And he offers them as their reward himself. And it's only when you see a God like this. And if you're not attracted to a God like this, then you won't like heaven. But when you see what sort of God he is and what he is willing to do for those like us who have consistently rebelled against him, how can we not want to be in his presence? For in his presence is fullness of joy, and before his face, when we are finally made whole without shame and we see him and we are like him, then we shall truly be happy. Then there is true blessedness. For this is the God of all glory, and he's calling us to share in that glory. May that be our heart's desire as we see the glory of God in the cross of Christ and we see the sort of God that we serve, a God who was slain in order that he could dwell among us and not break out against us. And therefore, he broke out against his Son in order to redeem you to himself. May to God be all praise and glory. Let us pray.